Everybody, I'm Mark. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Larry for inviting me out. I met Larry, I think it was last September, on a retreat weekend. And so it's good to be sober. It's good to be here. And thank you for your talk. That was wonderful. I identify. You know, that's one thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And we speak the language of the heart, and we can identify. I mean, I can identify with that. And, you know, there's a lot of places that, you know, in my work or places that I can talk about things going on with me that they have no clue, you know. And you're not going to, you know, let them know you're not, you know, your feelings, and you're feeling a little inadequate, and, you know, and, you know, you just, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank my wife for coming up with me. My good friend Sherry and Mike drove down from Oceanside, you know, we made a day of it, you know. Palmdale's about 3.5 hours from here, and, you know, it's not quite the end of the earth, but you can see it from there. And, you know, but I would drive this far to drink, you know. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, nothing stopped me from drinking. You know, I love the effect produced by alcohol. And what I've come to understand today is that I love the effect produced by Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been that sufficient substitute that has replaced that malady that I suffer from, that spiritual malady, that lack of spirit in me that alcohol used to give me. Because I think from my very first drink, for me, it was almost like a spiritual awakening. You know, it did something to me that nothing else ever could. And after my first drink, after the first time I started drinking, sobriety or normal living never looked the same. I never wanted to go back to the way I felt before I took a drink. Because I was a big kid. I grew up in a big family, and I was always so self-obsessed and in my head thinking about all this stuff all the time. I couldn't focus on anything other than me. And, man, it was like the first drink I had relieved me from the bondage of self. And it was a miracle. I thought it was, I had never had anything that shut me down like that. And then the next day, you know, my head's waiting for me when I wake up. You know, and that's been the story of my alcoholism. It's I'm not the same as other people that I know and family members, you know. I come from a long line of heavy drinkers or alcoholics, you know. I'm Irish, Italian, Cherokee Indian, and our family likes to drink. And my dad had 7 brothers and 2 sisters, and we got lots of aunts and uncles, cousins, relatives, everybody drinking. You know, I grew up in a time when it was all about the party, you know. It was all about drinking. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley for the most part, you know, and back then it was all about cruising Van Nuys Boulevard on a Wednesday night. It was, you know, drinking all night long, going to kegger parties, you know, heading out to County Line Beach, building bonfires and drinking. And, you know, I remember I was sober about 45 days. And Cliff from down here, Cliff R., came up to talk where I was in the San Fernando Valley where I was getting sober. And he said that he felt like one of the 20 questions should be, have you ever come to with the roof of your mouth sunburnt? And I identified so much with that because that was my story drinking on the beach, you know. And just, I mean, you know, we'd go build these bonfires and drink till 4 or 5 in the morning, and then I'd pass out, and I'd come to with blisters all over my face, you know, listening to, like, you know, just somebody, family or something over here saying, just stay away from the man, you know, and I just, like, oh my God, you know. You know, my face was almost as red as Larry's. But, God, I don't know. You know, it just, alcohol did something for me, you know, and I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous does for me what alcohol did, does more for me today than whatever alcohol ever did. My sobriety date is January 1st of 1990. My home group is the High Desert Big Book group in Palmdale. And if you're ever in Palmdale, which probably won't be, we invite you to come visit us. And, you know, I I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my sponsor was up talking at my home group last night, and my sponsor Bob is. I've had him as a sponsor now for 22 years, and you know, that man knows everything about me, and that man knows the way I feel before I. You know, I'm so, and I'm current with that man. That's the most important thing for me, is to be transparent and not to live in a life of secrets anymore, not to have these secrets that I have to hide behind, or these images that I have to hide behind, that I can just be me. And man, I could never just be me. Just being me was never enough. And when I was, you know, that's one of the reasons I drank, you know, is not to be me. You know, 1966, I'm 7 years old, and my dad is buying a home in Northridge. We were living in Inglewood at the time, and you know, my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles were always down in Inglewood. That was where our family household was in Inglewood. And my dad buys this house in Northridge. My mom's pregnant with my little sister. We moved to Northridge, and my mom gives birth to my little sister, and about 4 months later, she suddenly passes away. And my dad is faced with an infant daughter and a seven-year-old boy, and a new home in Northridge, and he's working in a business that he's on the go a lot. He's moving around a lot. He's a sound guy for NBC News, so he's always busy, always going. And what he had to do was, you know, he ended up moving my grandfather, my grandmother, my Uncle Denny, my Uncle Mike, my Aunt Sis, my Aunt Teresa, my Uncle Jerry, all to the house in Northridge. And that house became the Coffee Insanity House. And it was a crazy, you know, because that was where everything happened. You know, as a kid going down, me and my cousins and everybody, we'd go down to Inglewood, and there would always be two things. It would be a poker game and a fight, no matter what. It was always happening because everybody would be drinking. And I have a bunch of cousins. I had, you know, my cousin Kirk was a year older than me. My cousin Gary, a year younger than me. Cousin Bobby, 2 years younger than me, and we ran around together. And after my mom passed away, we moved, and everybody moved to our house. There was no supervision for me. My dad was gone all the time. And his youngest brother, my Uncle Jerry, was only 4 years older than me. And Uncle Jerry was the cool uncle. As a matter of fact, he was the first one that ever gave me anything. You know, I remember as clear as today the first time I drank. And Because my cousin Kirk, my cousin Gary, and I all three drank at the same time. And it was a Saturday morning. I don't know how old we were. We were young. I mean, I was watching cartoons. It was a Saturday morning, and we drank some Old English 800. And he gave us some of this stuff to smoke. And, you know, we were just, man, it was great, you know, and Jerry was the cool uncle. Jerry was like my older brother. And Jerry was the kind of, you know, we would do anything for Uncle Jerry because we wanted his approval. And Uncle Jerry was in the lowrider car clubs. And he always had these people around, these girls around that were like, they had that ratted up hair, way up high, all the makeup, you know, mini skirt, no underwear. And, you know, they were like, they were just, you know, when you're 13 and 14 years old, and they're falling out all over the place on reds and alcohol, you're going to just, you have no problem keeping that Impala, you know, waxed and those Kregers shined. And, you know, if you can keep that car in good shape, you can hang out with Uncle Jerry. And Uncle Jerry would let us do that, you know, and Uncle Jerry would take us cruising Van Nuys Boulevard. And, you know, I remember me and my cousins, we just had a ball with it, you know, and man, Uncle Jerry would, you know, it'd be me and Kirk and Gary, the three of us, in the back seat of this Impala, and him and one of his friends, and they'd pick up some girl hitchhiking, and they'd throw her in the back with us. And we'd be like 13, just like squirm, you know. And he would tell us if we didn't at least try something, he's going to kick our butts, you know. And it's like, it was just, I don't know, you know. I don't know if that just came out of my memory bank. But, that, you know, it was, that was a lot of fun back then. I mean, that was... It was a challenge, but it sure was easier when we had a few drinks, you know. And I was always the big guy. I was always the guy that was shy and withdrawn and into my head so much. My cousin Kirk and my cousin Gary were both like long blonde hair, blue eyes. They got all the girls. They were good in sports. They dropped out of, junior high school. They didn't go to high school. You know, they were into, pulling burglaries and robbing places and going to jail. And I was the guy that, at 16, I've got two jobs so I can afford to drink and have a car. And, they were the guys that were stealing my car and robbing liquor stores, I'm a typical day would be for my cousins and I, me, Kirk, and Gary, to go to Alpha Beta. And Gary was like a little lightning rod. He was really fast, and he would just grab a gallon of tequila and a gallon of whiskey and just bolt out the door, run. And they're never going to catch me, And Kirk's in the back of the store shoving filet mignons down his pants. He's got these, back then we were all wearing army jackets in, like, August, he's shoving these filet mignons down his pants and I'm in line buying charcoal, I was just the chicken one of the bunch, and then I would drive around the neighborhood looking for them because I'm the one with the car. But, man, we had some good times, I don't know, drinking just felt natural to me. I think the way I felt when I wasn't drinking, I was so withdrawn, I was so afraid, now I realize that after getting sober, I realized that I was restless, irritable, and discontent before I ever took a drink. I was absolutely so caught up in my own selfishness and self-centeredness and self-think. Everything revolved around me and in my head, and I couldn't shut that down. And alcohol was able to just let me, it took it away. It was miraculous what alcohol did for me. And it was very difficult to ever get rid of it, to ever not drink. And I couldn't drink all the time, but boy, whenever I had the chance, I did. And growing up, I got aunts and uncles that are all drinking, and a couple of my aunts were on welfare. They were working the system. They had like 9 doctors to get, diet pills from. And, they told me I was fat, so they gave me diet pills, when I was like 14 or something. And all that did for me was allow me to drink the way I wanted to drink, I'm the kind of guy, I'm not a drink and pass out guy. I'm not a downer kind of guy. I want to drink and stay up. I don't want to miss nothing. Because it seems like when I start to drink, I'm so attuned to everything that's going on around me. And I'm so interested in everything that's going on around me that I don't want to miss nothing, I won't take a shower for a couple of days just to not miss something, I'm just that guy that what I miss, I somebody laughs in the other room and I have to be in there to find out what it is. But, man, I don't know. It just, drinking became a way of life, it was that way in my whole family anyway. My grandparents were the same way. I remember growing up, I went to Catholic school. I remember early on as a kid in Northridge getting, putting my little Catholic school uniform on, sitting down to have my breakfast at 6:30 in the morning, Frosted Flakes, sitting next to me is my grandfather and my Uncle Denny. And they're playing cribbage, drinking Schlitz and Old Forester. And that's at 6:30 in the morning. So it was just such a normal thing, But all through high school I drank, My cousins and I, we ran that valley together. We did everything together. We drank and had a lot of fun. And while I was in high school, I met this girl that I started dating at an early age. I was like 14 and she was 13, and all through high school we were together. And once I started drinking, I just come up with these plans and that I don't plan on keeping. And one of them was we were going to get married right out of high school. And the reality was is that she was engaged and I wasn't, and I was just this dog. And anytime I had an opportunity, I would cheat on her. And all through high school, she went to a different high school, and I was in this high school, and It seemed like that right out of high school, she moved over from Simi Valley to Northridge and started working with a whole bunch of people I went to high school with. And all of a sudden, she's got my picture on her desk at work, and they're like, Mark? With the cousins Kirk and Gary? Oh, how long have you been engaged to him? And I start getting in trouble, you know. And I'm working at Gemco department stores, and I fall in love with this other girl that's working there, and I'm supposed to get married to Doreen, and I'm in love with this girl, Mary, who's in the Ice Capades, and she's getting ready to go on tour in the Ice Capades, and I don't know, I'm juggling a bunch of stuff, and you know, but once I start to take a drink, I don't care about anybody but me, you know, it's like, that's just normal, I mean, what the heck, you know, and anyway, long story short was, by the time I was supposed to go and to get married, and I had this other girlfriend, and you know, my Uncle Jerry had moved to Colorado, and I called him one day, and I told him what the predicament I was in, that I'm engaged here, and I'm in, like this other girl, and she's going to go on tour in the Ice Capades, and if I come to live with you in Colorado, and maybe Mary can come to after the tour, come to Colorado and stay. And so we planned this big thing where she's going to go on tour in the Ice Capades, and after 4 months on tour, she'd come live with me in Colorado. So I left the one I was engaged to and just left town and moved to Colorado to live with my Uncle Jerry again, you know, out there. And I remember, you know, this whole thing, you know, the ice skater, I remember, you know, I'm driving away, we're like in tears and this whole drama, you know, and I'm like, and I'm sending flowers and money and cards at every stop in the Ice Capades, you know, and meanwhile, the one I dumped is like just pet, you know, mortified, and anyway, to this day, I've never heard from the ice skater, and I swear for like 6 months, I sent cards and flowers and, you know, And you know, I just what went around came around. And long story short, I moved to Colorado, and I started working with this company with my Uncle Jerry. And my Uncle Jerry and I, he's like my older brother. And, you know, I remember I was there. I was only 19. I was living in Colorado. I was drinking in the bars there because I was with Jerry. And, you know, and it was great. You know, I got involved in an industry that was fueled by drugs and alcohol. And this was in the 70s, and we were wholesale manufacturers and distributors of waterbed products. And we sold waterbeds to all of the waterbed stores all over the country. And we would set up waterbed departments and furniture stores. And most of the old waterbed shop owners, they kind of evolved out of the head shop. Because, you know, the first place I ever saw a waterbed was in the blacklight poster room of a head shop. And it seemed like all these waterbed store owners were ex-head shop owners, and everybody drank. And everybody did other things. And me and my uncle were always drinking and doing stuff. And waterbeds were like crack. You couldn't get enough of them. They were selling like crazy. And it was just an incredible business to be in, you know. And, you know, I was in Denver for 3 years with that company. And the company made a lot of money and kept growing. And you know, they're going to open up another distribution center. And when I was 22 years old, they sent me to run the distribution center in Chicago. They opened a new place in Chicago, and they gave me a corporate apartment with a company car, an expense account. And I felt like Bill Wilson when he says in Bill's story, I had arrived. You know, and that's the way I felt when I got to Chicago. And Chicago was my kind of town because I like the bars that are open until 5 in the morning. I love the blues music. I love jazz. I go downtown, down to Halstead Street, down to Rush Street, and drink all night. I got no bosses to attend to. I got a waterbed showroom with about 50 beds set up. You know, I'm bringing people from the bars to the showroom. You know, it's just crazy, you know. But, man, life is good. Alcohol's working. And alcohol was doing good, you know. And the more I drank, the more invincible I felt like I became. And it didn't matter how bad I was at my job or how much time I missed from work, waterbed still kept selling. By now, in order for me to drink the way I want to drink and be, there's something about going to a bar for me that I can't leave until it closes. You know, I just, it's really weird. I mean, I just, until I run out of money or the bar closes, I won't leave. And I think I'm going to miss something. And, you know, I remember going for drinks after work with guys from work, and they're like, well, I got dinner waiting for me or something. That didn't compute to me. I just didn't understand that. And anyway, so by now I'm doing this. It's the 80s, and I'm doing this other substance that's keeping me up, and I'm drinking a lot. And you know what, though? It's all about alcohol. The other thing that was just nothing more than just a keep. It was a prevention for me not to pass out. And but, you know, I'm... it's crazy. My life is spiraling out of control. I'm no longer wasting any time with beer or wine. I've become a whiskey drinker and a Long Island iced tea drinker, and I want to get there down. I want to get there quick. You know, I remember the first time I heard Norm Alpie's tape. He talked about getting downtown, and I understood that to my inner self. I understood that because that's the way I drank, with a feverish thing, and I get to. You know, we were there, and Chicago's doing good, and I'm going crazy. And my mind tells me that I need to get out of Chicago. If I wasn't in a town where the bars were open till 5, I wouldn't have to stay there till 5. It just made sense to me. It was so they opened up a new location, and you know, I felt if I got out of Chicago and the bars were open till 5, I'd be able to get away from cocaine too. And but they opened up this new location. They sent me to run that one since I had experience in running a waterbed place, you know, and but that was in Florida, and that was a bad place to go to get away from that stuff. And I found myself in Florida, and it's on hard there, and I'm drinking around the clock, and I'm really starting to affect my work, and I can't, you know, by now I'm in sales, but after I'm up for a few days drinking, I can't even talk, and it's hard to sell something when you can't talk. And I just, it was crazy. And my alcoholism progressed, so did my, it's kind of weird for my, the way my alcoholism progressed was it took me back from being the life of the party, being alcohol, giving me that spiritual experience, that spiritual awakening to be on top, to be fun and loving and love life. Now, it's almost like towards the end of my drinking, I'm at back of that place before I ever took a drink. I'm consumed with myself. I'm withdrawn from society. The book describes me as I became disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. I became a lone wolf and I withdrew from society. And towards the end of my drinking, in the last 2 or 3 years of my drinking, I couldn't be around people. And I finally ended up losing that job. You know, I finally ended up getting fired from that waterbed job. Because I was drinking all the time. And I got a DUI in a company car. 2 weeks later, I got picked up on a suspended license, driving on a suspended license. And by now, I have to go to the bar every day at noon because I'm shaking. I need to have a drink. And then I take off at noon to borrow a coworker's car to go to the bar, and I get arrested. And I got 5 guys from Manpower unloading semi-trucks full of merchandise, and I'm the only one with keys, and I'm in jail. And so they call my boss in Colorado, and he's got to fly out and close the business that day. And then I got fired that day. And, you know, long story short with that is that it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, but I started to continue to drink a lot, and my life started to spiral, and I started working for this one of my customers. You know, I was selling to the retail stores. Now I'm working for this customer of mine, and at the same time, I've got this huge debt that I've incurred from this other stuff, and the guy that I owe the money to, his girlfriend owns a bar, and it's a strip club, and so I figure if I can go work some of my debt off over there. I was over there as a bartender and a kind of a bouncer at this biker strip club. It was basically a biker clubhouse in St. Pete, Florida. And, you know, I'm showing up in my OP shorts, Hawaiian shirts. I'm about 100 pounds lighter than I am now. and just defiant. You know, I'm just that defiant alcoholic. And and I ended up having to leave Florida on the run because I owed this guy a lot of money. And he turned the debt over to somebody else. Before I left Florida, I met a girl at the bar. I convinced her and her 3-year-old son, if we go to California, everything's going to be wonderful. And I'll get a job working. You know, I got all this stuff lined up. I had nothing lined up. You know, once I have a few drinks, there's no such thing as a bad idea. And I just start, rambling, whatever. And so I bring this girl out. We leave in the middle of the night on the run. I bring this girl out to California. And I got nothing lined up, We're going to Dad's house in Northridge, just, on the couch. And no job, no money, no nothing. And, so I continued to drink for a couple more years. But the thing that happened when I came back to California is that the first thing I wanted to do was hook up with my cousins because I hadn't seen them in about 10 years. That cousin Kirk and Gary of mine that I used to drink with all the time. And I call up Gary and I said, man, I'm back in town. We haven't been in contact for years. What's going on? He says, oh, Mark, I'm so glad you're here. We're having a party at El Torito Restaurant. Come on down. And so I go down to this party on Ventura Boulevard at El Torito Restaurant. I get there a little early. I start drinking shots of tequila and drinking. And I got my wife with me. She's my girlfriend then, but she's my wife now. We're all drinking. And, I'm drinking. She's not. And all of a sudden, I don't know what's going on around me, but all of a sudden, they start singing happy birthday to my cousin Gary, and they bring a cake out, and there's a 5 on it. Kind of like that 5, that 2-5 I saw tonight. But there's a 5 on it, and I don't know what that is. And he's 5 years sober. And my cousin Kirk is 7 years sober. And I had never heard of being sober. I didn't understand it. I really didn't. I got the hell out of there, it never dawned on me why somebody wouldn't drink. It was a solution to my life. I'd never been in a place. I'd never gone to rehab. I'd never been a place. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the old-fashioned way. I walked into an AA meeting, and I've been here since my first meeting. But my cousins were sober, and they were so much worse than I were. They were like, when I left California, my cousin Gary was homeless living in a hobo camp in North Hollywood Park, and my cousin Kirk was making the rounds on all the aunts and uncles' couches. And I felt like they were a lot worse than I ever was. And if they could get sober, But I continued to drink for another year and a half, and by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd run out of ideas. And they were my only example of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I knew how bad they were growing up. And their lives were going good. My cousin Kirk and my cousin Gary had this light in their eye. My cousin Gary had this thriving painting contracting business. This beautiful wife he met in AA. These two gorgeous kids. And man, I wanted what he had. And, I wanted to feel that way again about life. And I couldn't do it, And anyway, they were the example. And they didn't try and shove AA down my throat. But they lived AA. They showed me through their actions. And I finally got sober a year and a half later. And I thought me and my cousins were going to ramble through Alcoholics Anonymous like we did out on the streets partying. And by the time I came into AA, they were slipping away from AA. And my cousins, both of them. In my first year and a half, I watched both of my cousins. I watched money, property, and prestige divert them from their primary purpose. I watched them both drink again. I watched my cousin Kirk get in a bad car accident, drunk, with his daughter in the car. And 18 months later, we had to take him off life support. And my cousin Gary, who's been in prison now for a long time, he's in Utah in prison right now. He has never been able to make it back to AA. I've tried 12-stepping him, in and out of AA, in and out of AA. Never been able to make it back. That was a wide open eye-opening for me early in sobriety, and scared the hell out of me because I started to feel something really special here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really started to connect with you people, And I was going to meetings every day, and it seemed like in my early meetings, the only time my head would shut down, I would get that relief like I had on a drink when I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's like the minute I would leave the meeting, my mind would start messing with me, you know, and then I would, you know, call my sponsor and it would subside. Go to the next meeting later that night and it'd be okay. Go home at night and my head's going crazy. You know, it just became, my Alcoholics Anonymous became the only place that was safe for me in early sobriety. And I fell in love with you. And I saw what you did for my cousins. And I watched what happened to them when they stopped going to meetings and when they stopped when their priorities became more than Alcoholics Anonymous. And it scared me, you know. And anyway, I remember I was sober. I don't know. I got a sponsor right away, and he got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had me going to you know, six meetings a week with commitments at most of my meetings. And, you know, he wanted me to show up an hour early to meetings. He wanted me to reach out, be a door greeter, you know. And, you know, when I was newly sober in my first couple of years, I didn't think I should be serving you. I felt you should be serving me. And, you know, and he took care of that right away, you know. And he had me doing stuff all the time. And he would say really stupid things to me, you know. I didn't get it at first, you know. But, you know, he told me that if I want to walk on water, pick up a mop, you know. And that was about after 3 years of sobriety when I felt like I was walking on water. Somewhere between, you know, 3 and 4 years, I knew everything. And, you know, I don't know, you know, he got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for Bob. And you know, my wife and I had a daughter, a baby girl. And, you know, I've got a 20-year-old daughter now that's never seen her daddy drunk. And I've got a you know, a 27-year-old stepson who doesn't remember me sending him to get my beers. But, you know, what happened for me is that Alcoholics Anonymous became this obsession and this way of life that I felt I really started to enjoy and love. And through taking the steps, I started to get a whole new outlook on life. And my, you know, my sponsor was really big into service work, getting me involved. And I remember there was a huge speaker meeting in Chatsworth at Mason and Lassen that I was a door greeter at for a year. And I would have to get there early and dress nice and be a door greeter. And, you know, I got to know everybody in that room. There was about 300 people in that room. And I got to get to know everybody in the room by being a door greeter. And I got to get there early and have a good seat at every speaker meeting. And one time this guy came up to share. I was sober, just a little, about 2 years sober. And this man was from Long Beach. His name was Johnny H. And he got sober the year I was born. And it was nothing about his story that resembled mine, but everything about what he talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, I was experiencing and I was living and I was feeling that love and that joy and that passion and that ease and comfort that came at once by working with another alcoholic, that came at once by doing a commitment, that came at once by being in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was talking to me about that, and I just felt, you know, it was really remarkable that day, that night. And I talked to him after the meeting, and, you know, the long story short is that my old roommate, when I lived in Colorado, he called me up one day. He said, "Mark, I'm getting married. I want you to come back to Colorado and be the best man at my wedding." And I was afraid to do that because I knew that all my old friends would be there. Everybody I drank with would be there. And my sponsor guaranteed that I could go there and be a sober member and be the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous your old friends will ever see. And I bought into it. So I bought the airline ticket to go back there. And, you know, then of course I was on my eighth and ninth step. And my sponsor said, Mark, when we did your fifth step, I remember you telling me how much you stole for 3 years from that waterbed store the last 3 years of employment. You were ripping them off left and right all the time. And I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "Well, good, you know, isn't the president of that company in the corporate headquarters in Colorado?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, you've got an airline ticket there and all, and you're going to be back there. And while you're back there, you need to contact them and make face-to-face amends and set up a payment restitution plan. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding. You know, I'm like, well, why did he wait till I bought the airline ticket to tell me this? You know, it's like sponsorship school. And anyway, you know, I go back to Colorado to be in this wedding, and I got everything lined up. You know, he's got me set up to go to a meeting. You know, it's Friday night in Boulder is where we're going. The hotel, the wedding's going to be in Boulder. I get to the hotel that Friday night off the plane. All my old friends are in the hotel room, and I start going. My mind just starts working me over. If I get drunk, I don't have to make those amends. That sounds good to me. You know, I don't have to deal with that, you know. And of course, it doesn't just come in and leave. It's like a engine piston the whole time, you know. But my sponsor, we had lined up someone to come pick me up for an AA meeting at the hotel that night. And I get to the hotel, and they're all drinking. They're all, you know, there's a whole bunch of guys in the bathroom. I know what's going on in the bathroom. You know, they're all drinking. They're doing their drugs. It's the bachelor party. The girls are going to be there soon. I ain't going to no meeting. And the horn honks. And I go out and get in the car to go to the meeting. And I go to this meeting, and they're closing up the meeting. And they say, sorry, we're not having a meeting here tonight. And I go, hey, guys, man, I can't go back to the hotel right now. I'm going to drink. You know, my mind's working me over. I give them the whole scenario. They say, don't worry, come with us. They drive me right back to the hotel right across the street from the hotels of Boulder University. That weekend at the Boulder University is an Alcoholics Anonymous convention. We go to the convention. The main speaker that Friday night when I sat down was Johnny H. from Long Beach, California. The guy that I had heard 2 weeks earlier in California. And it was at that moment that I came to believe in a power greater than myself. It was at that moment that I absolutely came to believe that there was a God in my life working. And it went from my head to my heart. And I remember talking to him after the meeting. And I told him, I just met you 2 weeks ago in Chatsworth, California. Because I know I remember talking to you. You know, and I've been going on retreats with this man. And that man's a vital part of my sobriety today. And, you know, it was just an amazing thing. And I got to go be the only sober member in that wedding party. And I got to go and meet my old boss and set up a restitution plan and tell him about everything I stole and make those payments. And as he's flying me to the airport the next day, he says, Mark, if you ever want a job in this company again, you have one. If you ever want to come back to Colorado, there's a job waiting for you. Man, I came back to LA on fire for the amends, you know. I was like, wow, this is easy. You know, and I wish I could tell you all of them went that well. But they didn't. I had troubles, you know, and, you know, the girl that I'd left, I had to make amends to her, you know. And, of course, you know, after that amends, I'm ready to go. I'm running around in my anxious little God suit to go make amends to everybody. And my sponsor had to hold me back and tell me, you know, and says, is she married? I go, yeah, she's married. She's got a couple kids. He goes, you had no right to go over there and mess her life up. And long story is, you know, later on in sobriety, you know, I had the opportunity to make an amends after she had gotten divorced. All these things come in God's time and not my time, and I try to force my will. My entire life now today is it seems like trying to, it's not the alcohol that I fight, it's my self-will that I have to fight. Don't get me wrong, alcohol is my problem. And it'll be my problem, because I know in the back of my head where the solution for the great pain is and will always be. But I come to understand that my selfishness and my self-centeredness, my self-will run riot, my self-delusion is the constant battle I struggle with. That practical experience shows that nothing will assure me immunity from drinking than constant work with others. And I've been a very active member in Alcoholics Anonymous my whole sobriety. I do Alcoholics Anonymous the same way I drank. Once I found that magic elixir and it made me feel good, I chased it that hard. And that's the way it's been in my sobriety. Thank God for that, because I couldn't survive otherwise, you know. And I was able to, you know, we got married. I moved from the San Fernando Valley out to Palmdale. Actually, I live in a town called Little Rock, but it's a small rural area. I bought a home when I was 3 years sober out there. Started working down in L.A., and I do this commute, this 2 hours each way commute. And the trade-off is that my wife didn't have to work, and could raise the kids, and I had to work and make that commute. And I'll tell you, it gets taxing. And I remember I was, you know, after being out there for just a year or two, I was angry all the time. I'd drive home pissed off, you know, and I'd be going to, I still had like 4 or 5 meetings a week, and I'm trying to do all these hours at work and commute, go to my meetings. I'm sharing in meetings how spiritual I am and all this crap. And I'm coming home, and I'm screaming and yelling and knocking things around, and I'm being a real jerk at home. And my I'm telling my sponsor about it, and he tells me, he gives me a specific instruction on something to do that I think is so lame that I wouldn't even do it. You know, he says, Mark, I know your route, and I want you to sing in the car out loud on your way home, right before you get home. And I go, Bob, what do you want me to sing? Come on, I'm angry. He goes, I know. He goes, I want you to start singing Zippity Doodah. And I told him, I said, you got to be kidding me. You know? And so I finally tried it after three days of calling him, and he said, did you sing? And I said, yes. I lied to him for a few days, and it didn't sit well with me. And then one day I tried it, you know. I started singing Zippity Doodah, Zippity-A. I'm driving home. You know, and he says, don't forget, Mark, that Mr. Bluebird is God. And I'm like, oh, okay, Bob, whatever. And I pull into the driveway, and, you know, you just can't sing Zippity-Doo-Dah and be angry. And by now, my whole household is waiting for me. They're on eggshells. They know I'm going to be a jerk when I come in, and I come in with this big grin on my face. And, you know, they probably think I'm smoking weed or something. You know, but amends that just transpired 3 weeks ago. And at 23 years sober, that guy that I left Florida, I knew that he was out after me. And I couldn't make the amends for a long time because I felt my family was at risk. And my 4 years sober, the book tells me, and my sponsor at the time told me, he says, you know what? The book says some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. So I wrote them an honest letter. I was driving across country. I mailed it from Tennessee without my driver. I don't even want them knowing what state I live in. It all went away. I felt fine. It went away for about 5 years. I felt complete with that amends. And then I'm in a book study, in a workshop. And the guy who's putting it on, we're reading about the amends. And he's talking about the ruthless creditors. And he says, what do you think a ruthless creditor was in 1939? The loan shark, the bookie, the bootlegger. It's not Visa or your student loan. So he equated the ruthless creditor to the drug dealer. And I finally got the guy's number after all these years, and I picked the phone up 3 weeks ago only because I was telling my sponsee that he had to do it. And I called the guy, and all these years I've been looking over my shoulder afraid. I called him, and he goes, Mark, man, I wonder whatever happened to you. God, it's so good to hear from you. I come to LA every once in a while. We got to get together and have dinner. You know, I haven't heard from you or seen you for years. And I'm like, oh my God, you know. And I have work to do with that. I gotta make some payments back to him and pay the money. But fancy it or real, I'm living in this delusion, thinking that I'm gonna be tracked down and killed if I don't, you know. And then I call the guy, and it's like, oh my God, I wonder whatever happened to you. So I don't know what's in store for me. I know that Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, left to my own devices, I'll self-destruct. And you know, my life is good, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you that I get it here in AA. And I get it because my life has taken on a new meaning. And I get the opportunity to watch people recover, to see the loneliness vanish, to see them help others. I get that in my home group. I don't get that sitting at home watching Law and Order. I got to see them come in. I got to watch the things change. And I hope you find what I've found. And I want to thank Larry for asking me up. And thank you.